This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
Yeah, no, Andrea, I gotta say, I think like you are in the less than one percentile of people who lack baseball knowledge. It's in this country, it is truly difficult to know less about baseball. Nothing. Like, you only know that
she knows the difference between a baseball and softball now, actually. Oh wait, which one's the yellow one?
The softball.
Right. Good job.
Yeah, but she guessed that. she looked up.
Welcome to the Voice San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I'm Scott Lewis, the CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego, and I'm joined, as always, by Managing Editor Andrea Lopez Villafana. What's up, Lopez?
Hey, Lewis.
And on remote connection, we have fellow Managing Editor Andrew Keats. What's up, Andy?
How you doing, pal?
Coming up on the show this week, we have an update on our main story from last week about a family struggle with homelessness. We'll pass along some good news for once. Very excited about that. Plus, pay incentives for teachers used to be taboo, at least to San Diego Unified School Board, but now they can't recruit for a key educator position, and they're changing their tone. We'll explain. Finally, the state's decision to allow a local housing project to break the San Diego coastal height limit, at least the one imposed by voters, was a big deal. Now we have more information about how that decision came together and the state's role in it. Annie got some emails. Good emails. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Last week, we also talked about the potential, or what we thought was almost a done deal, settlement in the 101 Ash saga. And then they opened Monday with the news trickling through all the reporters that they weren't actually going to have the settlement vote. It was off. So we have some theories, obviously, about why that might have happened, but just some background. Remember, the city has been suing the entity that sold, or sort of leased to own, the tower of 101 Ash Street, the former Sempra headquarters across the street from City Hall, and the tower across the plaza from City Hall, Civic Center Plaza, excuse me, CCP.
CCP.
Yeah.
CCP. As distinguished from CAB and COP.
COP. Right, correct. That CAB had purchased COP, or CCP.
And the inhabitants of CAB purchased CCP to relocate the staffers that worked in Cobb
because of the obvious problems with Cobb.
Obvious problems with
that
Cobb,
CAB couldn't
which
fix.
Felt doubly at CAB. Yeah.
So they we were going to settle with, as a city, with the landlord. Mm-hmm. Now our case, as represented by the city attorney, is that this deal, this lease to own deal for both these buildings, was corrupt and illegal and should be clawed back, because the broker who had been assisting the city with all of its real estate needs like this for some time had a conflict, because he had a contract with the landlord, the seller, that he was going to enjoy a significant portion of the profits or have to pay a significant portion of their losses if the city didn't make this deal.
Right. So the city was arguing that that was obviously motivation for them to get the deal accepted.
Right. So that it was illegal that he had that conflict, and the remedy that the law provides is that those things should be unraveled and clawed back. Now, remember, we left last week with the city attorney's objections to them settling the suit with the landlord, and the argument that the mayor and others seem to have that this would put to rest a lot of these issues, and our speculation that part of what motivates them is that they were looking forward to having all these buildings, Cab, Cobb, CCP, 101 Ash, all of them under one ownership, the city's ownership, and they could redevelop the whole area.
Right. And I think we talked about how they acknowledged, you know, that, well, this is kind of like a crappy situation and we got to do something.
Yeah. And I remember one of the things we brought up was like, well, if you're going to settle with the landlord, but not with the broker we're talking about, Jason Hughes, what's going on there? Because the case is the same for both, right? If your case is strong against the landlord, then it's strong against Hughes, or vice versa. If it's strong against Hughes, why would you stop against the landlord? And so obviously they want the building, but something happened Monday. Andy, there's a few options about what could have happened. One is maybe they didn't have the votes for the settlement. The mayor said, well, we just wanted to give people, they asked for more time to digest the whole settlement and the analysis about it. So we're giving them more time, but they usually don't go forward with things unless they know they have the votes. So either they lost the votes or maybe never counted them.
It's possible that this is the first time that the procedural explanation is true.
Yeah.
But I doubt it.
Yeah.
I think the official explanation is that the public, there was a, that they heard and understood the public outcry for more time. So they're going to provide it and come back in a month.
So I guess there's an option that they either lost the vote or some new bit of information came up and we have no idea about that.
Also, we're just very, very silly people for assuming that something would come to any sort of culmination. It was a very dumb thing to think.
It was docketed. Every time we do it. That seems like something can rest on. It was on the agenda for Monday to be settled.
So, it is profound how many times I have decided to kick that football.
And always missed.
I pull it away every time.
Well, we will update you when and if that ever comes back or any developments along the way. Well, last week we also featured the story of the Rashke family. So Lisa Halverstadt came on the podcast, talked to Lopez here about her story following the Rashke family and their odyssey through homelessness. They showed up in San Diego with an RV after having had jobs here and got jobs here, but could not find a place. And then it's just a real heartbreaking story about how many times they fell apart right as they were getting things together, right? Like they'd have their RV impounded, lots of tickets. It was just a very bleak description of just how hard it is to be homeless and how expensive it is, frankly. So we ran that story and a lot of things happened since then. First, the city council had a big discussion about safe parking lots, the kind of parking lot that if it had the access that they do now have with this new approval of 24 hours, this family could have benefited from that. That went forward as a discussion at the city council, and the council president, Sean Elo Rivera, invited Natalie Rashke, who we featured, to come and talk about the story and what happened and her experience at that hearing. And she discussed how, even as she started getting connected with services, even if you have the money, this is what's so interesting, even if you have the money for renting a place, like often it's even harder to actually find a place, get somebody to accept you, go on from there.
They're doing, because I'm a mom of four, they're going to help me pay my first month's rent and deposit, but they're not. I get no help looking for these places or what places are available that are going to take, you know, the voucher that I have or the help that I have. Because you're already coming as getting help from the city or the government, you don't look like a good candidate in that sense either.
We have an update on the family. So after our story ran, the Housing Commission connected with them, and they both are getting help. They raised money from their own GoFundMe. They got into a hotel for a few days, and they are getting a permanent three-bedroom apartment in Mission Valley. So the only problem is that they can't move into it until August. So they are going to be needing some safe parking and other temporary options until then. Hotels have been running about $250 a night for them, and some donors have helped. So I felt a couple ways with this. One is I was overjoyed that our journalism helped somebody like this and helped them so immediately that they got the attention and that the city reacted as fast as it could and is making policy adjustments and adjustments to help this family. But it also felt like she kind of won a little bit of a lottery for folks in their situation, and it nothing systemic is changing, and there's still probably thousands of people that could use that kind of help, and we're not going to be able to profile all of them.
Yeah, I think the thing with this story, and even from the moment when we were just editing it and I was telling Andy that I think there's so many points in this family story where they just couldn't get their head above water. And, you know, you go through this story, you go through this article, and it's a story about this family. But then when you start thinking about how all the other people on the street, or, you know, couch surfing or living in their cars just like this family, are dealing with those same systemic issues, it's really sad. And so I agree. I mean, you know, I'm really happy for them, and they have hit the lottery, but there's so many other families going through the same thing.
Yeah. The same week we wrote a story, Jesse Marks wrote a story about how quickly a ticket that you get in your car for, like, say, no registration can turn into a massive debt. And if you're already struggling, can just burden you for years. And it's like, and then that financing is like key to financing so much of the actual judicial court's infrastructure. They depend on people being trapped in this kind of debt mess. And I think that all these stories always come up with that same sort of reality that, like, if you start to fall behind in this circus we have going here, you have a really hard time climbing out of it. And it's almost just a video game of things being thrown at you, except that it's your life, and you end up on the street or you know, worse along the way. And it's no wonder that so many people get depressed or sick or addicted along the way.
Well, it feels like you just can't catch a break. Like, no matter what you do, something just keeps pushing you back. And so what do you do at that point?
After we published this story, the mayor's office, the city council president's office, the housing commission, you know, housing commissioners got involved directly and independently. And it was only through that sort of sheer force of will of many of these powerful people that the Rashkes were able to receive housing. And, you know, not only are we not able to profile everybody who may be in a situation like this, it's just almost illustrative of how uncaring the system is, that you need that level of intervention for one person to just rise above the fray and be put into a household. And similarly, the sort of sense of emptiness that you're sort of describing, Scott, where you're happy, but yet it feels so much like nothing has really been fixed because of such a lottery-like result. I imagine that must be exactly how people who work in this space feel every day.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, that they do get to place people with vouchers into a house. And I'm sure that they have to celebrate that victory every time it happens, mm-hmm. even while fully knowing that for every person with a voucher that was put into a house, you've got, you know, more than 10 people who are not so lucky. And just what a long way we are from any sort of lasting, meaningful sustainable solution.
Well, it also is a vivid illustration of just the exact lag that is in the system right now for the most plugged in potential supported person, right? Like, think about it. If this family has had essentially the entire city infrastructure around these issues mobilized on their behalf, right? We run the story, the city council president, mayor, and housing commission all mobilize as much as they can for them, and then they are pulled out, and they get a permanent place in Mission Valley in August. That there is for even the people who are mobilized for the most, the quickest, the most possible action you can see from your local region, it that you still can't get a place till August is really interesting and vivid illustration of just how big the gap is between the need for permanent housing and the availability.
So a couple months ago, maybe?
Yeah.
You sat me down in the conference room and you gave me a Scott talk. people here that work at Voice of San Diego get Scott talks. I find them interesting.
It's Thank one you. Of his employment benefits. It's written into his contract that he gets to do that.
In the job description.
But you like him.
I like him.
Thank you. Andy likes him too, but he just has to be mean about it.
I'm being nice.
Okay.
I'm just happy that you get to do the thing that you love. That makes me happy, knowing that you're happy.
So we sat down and you were breaking down the super complex education system and what kind of stories to look out for. And I don't even think we finished because there was so much.
Yeah.
But one of those, I had different questions about, like, well, why don't they offer money for teachers for certain schools? And you know, why can't we have teachers who have a lot of experience teaching at schools that really need teachers with experience? And you broke that down for me. But that ties into a story that we ran this week.
Yes. One of the things that has always bothered me is that there are schools out there that deal with massive turnover every year. It's just, and it's really hard for them to build a culture of success, of accountability, of the principals to get sort of their grounding and create a stable environment so that they can deliver results for these kids. And these kids in areas that are often the most and traditionally underserved areas. And so you look at, like, Knox Middle School, for example. We started adding average years of teaching experience at these schools so you could track, in a way, like, turnover in them. And so
To our parents guide.
Yes, yeah, sorry. In our parents guide, our annual parents guide to San Diego schools. And we had, at Knox, for example, we had registered 9.4 as the average year's teaching experience in that. And that's, you know, probably acceptable in some industries, but compared to other schools, especially schools that are doing a lot better in all the outcomes you would expect, and also in things like chronic absenteeism and stuff like that, De Portola Middle School in Tierra Santa, 16.9 years average experience. What happens is they come in, teachers have to start at a school like Knox, and then they get out as soon as they can. And that's all based on seniority. And so for years, we've had this conversation. We're like, can you do something, anything, to provide these kids at Knox a better experience, a more stable environment where there's not so much constant turnover, where teachers aren't so excited to get out of there, and seniority is not sort of punishing that school and its culture all the time? And the single answer that has always come up is, well, maybe you could pay people more to teach there. Just change the dynamics. And that has always been hostily rejected. And so this month, Will Hunsberry and others who saw this news were a little bit surprised to see San Diego Unified School District announce that it was going to offer $10,000 signing bonuses for new special education teachers to deal with the shortage of people who wanted to do that work at the prices they were paying. And that work is vital work, similar to teaching in traditionally underserved areas that have cultures that need more stability. They were having trouble recruiting people for that. And they're offering an incentive to change that dynamic. And so Will, I thought, did a great job in his piece kind of exploring, was this the first of their efforts to maybe break that taboo as sort of a progressive union-influenced school board to support some sort of more flexibility to kind of change that dynamic? And basically the answer he got back was no.
So just for this occasion.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I thought was most interesting was an old quote that Will had from Richard Barrera, the leader of the school board, who had said years ago when Will asked him about incentive pay to go to work in underserved schools, or you know, schools that most need to create a stable environment with more veteran teachers. And what Richard Barrera said then was, that's the last thing we want. That then you would have people who would only be going there because there was money in it. And what you want is people who go to those schools because their heart is in it. And if you simply apply that logic, then you're saying here that you've done something dire to the special education classrooms of this school, because you now have people who are only going to be taking that job because there was a $10,000 signing bonus in it. Now, I don't think that's actually something to worry about. But if we take on face value what Richard Barrera said about the idea of using this very similar incentive structure to get people into schools that need improvement, that is what you would necessarily believe about the decision to apply this to special education classrooms.
Yeah, and just also add that, like, the heart hasn't worked. And so at some point, what are you going to do to change that dynamic? I mean, you're going to just give them more inspirational speeches, make them watch Stand By Me? What are they going
to
do?
Well, you can have, like, your heart can be set on wanting to help underserved communities, students who are underserved. But if you're a teacher with little experience, and all the teachers around you are teachers with little experience, then all these, you know, traumas that you're being exposed to, things you're seeing your children deal with, you know, homelessness or whatever it is, right? That weighs heavily on you. Even if you have the heart in it, you're going to say, well, you know, nobody really here around me has a lot of experience. Help me go through this, learn how to deal with what situations my students are dealing with. And if now I have more seniority, then, you know, I do have the heart in it. But, like, I'm also thinking about myself. I'm also a human. Like, teachers are humans, too. So they're, you know, obviously going to choose an option to move to a school where you're surrounded by people who can support you. But, you know, if you have the heart and you have $10,000, that might make it easier. And maybe you get more people to stay.
And it could change the dynamic, the culture, and make it easier for some, you know, people to then stay longer after that. Something has to break in that.
But it doesn't look like it's going to.
Yeah, I mean, public policy that seeks to solve problems by appealing to people's better selves and acting in contravention of their financial interests is does not have an especially good track record. But I would ask, Scott, were you at all convinced by Richard Barrera's, this is with Will, in this most recent story, his attempt to distinguish between paying teachers extra to fill a staffing shortage versus paying them extra to help schools that need it most? In that, I guess the sentiment being, there isn't a staffing shortage at, you know, Knox Elementary. It's just a sort of, it's like this sort of creature of the seniority system, that that people are underexperienced, but they are there. Is that a distinction that holds up to you?
I mean, it's one, I guess, to cling to. Sure, you can say that staffing is adequate at these schools, but I think that the outcomes are not. I don't think anyone would look at some of the schools and the situations they're in and the turnover, the constant turnover there, and say that this is ideal. That's what you want. So what is, if not this, then what is the plan to address it? And that'd be fine if there was something obvious there. But for years, and I think this is just one of the many myriad education issues, that if you had it in a different place, if half the teachers every year were leaving De Portola or, you know, one of these other schools or Scripps Ranch or something, you would, there would be stories like CBS 8 would show up and be like, these parents are worried about teachers leaving this school. And it's just an expected outcome for these other schools. It's just the way it is there. It's the same way I did a big story a few years ago about AP classes, an AP class that was shut down at Lincoln High School, and I didn't get much traction out of it. But then they shut down a few, or planned to at Patrick Henry, and the whole community explodes. You know, it's just like there's just something wrong where we just assume that that's the area going there. So no, I wasn't persuaded necessarily by his take on that. The point is, if you're having trouble keeping people or recruiting them to certain areas, you need to think about, A, is there a culture problem, or B, is there a pay and incentive program or problem? And if you've just X'd those both out and say, no, it's just, you know, just part of life, like that's just hopeless and kind of sad.
Mm-hmm. Is it so the school board has been against incentives and the unions too? Do they have the same reasoning or?
I think if you broke down the union's reasoning, they would see it as a slippery slope, that once you start to pay, you know, somebody more for X, then somebody's going to say, well, you should pay more for higher achievement or merit pay. And that's been a big fight for them for a long time. Like, you don't want to pay people based on the outcomes of these tests that they can't really control what goes into them, that sort of thing. And so there that you once you start like adding incentives and distinctions in pay, you can really go down a slippery slope of inequity across the sort of adult ranks. And so that balance between the inequity across the adult ranks versus the inequity of experience of the kids is kind of like the ever living story of education. I think it's a great story. Anyway, we do have a new reporter starting on education. He got a Scott Talk the other day, Jacob McWinney, and I'm excited for him. If you have story ideas, get it to him. And you can see all of our education stories, including the latest one here from Will Huntsbury at voicesofsandiego.org/education. We're going to take a quick break. On the other side, Keats has got the receipts. Stay with us.
Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
Still think this isn't getting enough attention. So the UT first broke the story about a developer, affordable housing developer in Pacific Beach that has succeeded in convincing the state that it should be allowed to build higher than San Diego's 30-foot coastal height limit allows because it's taking advantage of the state's density bonus program, which allows them to build higher regardless of local laws if they build affordable housing to a certain degree on their site. And the implications of that are, of course, that if you build those affordable units, you can pierce that 30-foot height limit without a vote of the people. That the height limit was put in place 50 years ago by a vote of the people. And so, again,
with one big caveat that applies only in the area that is covered by the city's coastal height limit, but not the state's coastal zone.
Okay.
So there's a slight area where the coastal zone does not cover that the city's height limit does, and so this distinction will apply only there.
Okay.
Which is, you know, whatever. I just saved us 100 emails.
I have a dumb question. Which came first, the state's coastal limit or the city's coastal?
Well, the state, what he's saying there is that the state doesn't have a coastal height limit necessarily, but he's saying it is a coastal zone, and that zone is governed by the California Coastal Commission. And that zone, I think the distinction he's making is that this interpretation of this height limit rule only applies to the city's height limit outside that coastal zone. There's no actual height limit the state imposes on the coastal zone, is there?
No, I mean, you could try to do all manner of things because the coastal zone is a discretionary body that could grant things. The issue was basically the coastal zone was defined with maybe a little bit more logic to it about what counts as the coast, whereas the coastal height limit, they needed a very simple boundary because it was going on a ballot and they needed to communicate to voters simply where they were talking about doing this. And so they, instead of defining the latitude and longitude of each specific part of it, they just said everything west of the five.
Which includes areas.
That includes areas that, A, don't fall in the coastal zone. And that's mostly because I think most logical people would assume that those aren't actually the coast, because they aren't. I mean, let's be serious. Like, Eastern Pacific Beach over by the car dealerships and stuff is no one's idea of the coast.
And the Walgreens on Rosecrans in Point Loma is not a coastal property.
Yeah, those are not surf spots, right?
So this ruling, I think, or this decision by the state was really interesting and has potential widespread ramifications for other projects that might do the same thing. And I think what you did in the politics report was try to find out what happened, like how this decision came. And you found, I think, something interesting, that the city wasn't exactly excited about this.
Yeah, they kind of had to be dragged along, basically. So we knew that the developer had put in their proposal with the city, including their sort of legal argument that they were allowed to do what they were proposing. What we didn't know, or what these emails and correspondences showed, was that the developer then in March reached out to the state and said, hey, it's been a few months. We submitted this to the city, and we sure aren't hearing anything back. We would like you to weigh in here about whether we're allowed to do this, because after all, we're trying to use the state's density bonus law in order to achieve something that you, the state, have decided is a priority, building affordable housing. And so right after that happened, basically, the state assigned a staffer to handle it, to look into this. And he set up a meeting in early April with somebody from the city's development services department. And told the developer, a lot of these emails are between the state and the developer. They were clearly in constant communication about this dilemma, about this decision. And the developer reached out to him and said, hey, I know you had this meeting with the city, and I'm dying to hear how it went. Can you tell me how it went? And the state official responded, well, spoke to one analyst who ended up unable to clearly comment, which in itself is a form of comment. The city is standing on attorney-client privilege at this particular moment and is not willing or able to share details of their position or legal reasoning. And then he added that the city person said, look, if this developer wants an answer, they should just submit the project for formal approval and we'll either tell them yes or no, and then they'll get their answer, which is not exactly like the sort of it's not the collaborative process that this developer was getting from the state, I'll say. Mm-hmm. And so it goes back and forth that way, with the state trying to get the city to talk to it and the developer asking the state what they were hearing and what was going on. The developer gets alarmed at that response and says, wow, it sounds like maybe we need to really formalize our push. Sort of expresses some confusion about the level of hostility that they're receiving. The city attorney's office gets roped into this. The state reaches out to the city attorney and says, like, hey, do you guys have an opinion on the matter? And the city attorney, like, couldn't wash their hands of the matter as quickly enough. They're just like, you should be talking to the development services. Yeah. They're the ones who know what's going on. We are not involved in this. Please keep our name out your mouth.
This issue of law and city policy is not our concern at the city attorney's office.
Yes. The state at this point starts to sort of express some confusion about how disinterested the city is in providing just a clear set reasoning for how they are making the decision that they're making. And so then the state is getting ready to hold another meeting with the city, and the developer reaches out and says, hey, in advance of your meeting today with the city staff, I just thought it was worth repeating that it's not our intention to be in an adversarial confrontation with the city. We are just trying to get a timely response on this issue. So that I think clarifies that, like, there was sort of a perception that things were getting testy between the developer and the city, and that the city was not acting in the same way that the state was about this. So then the state decides that they are going to take up this issue, that they're going to issue their own declaration on what the policy is here and whether it is true that developers can breach the coastal height limit. And when they do so, they say, look, we're not going to weigh in on your project. We're going to weigh on this issue in general as a whole, and we're going to, you know, treat it as a policy decision that we're making for all developers. And adds at the end, we get calls regularly from other developers and land use attorneys, so this is clearly an issue is clearly broadly known among the members of the San Diego development community, which I take to mean we believe that there are a lot of developers out there who have had this same thought, have viewed the legal question here in the same way you have. They just haven't been quite so insistent on forcing the issue and getting a final resolution in the matter. Which, if that's true, if that's the case, then now that there is some resolution on the matter, now that the state has weighed in, you would think that all those other interested developers may suddenly come back and say, oh, okay, well, if that's the case, then let's do this. In which case, this would be not just a one developer issue, but something you could start to see a lot of in that little sliver of the coast.
Yeah, I think it, and yet another example of the state's housing and community development department having its say over what San Diego's doing. So they're the ones controlling basically the process for the sports arena redevelopment effort. Mm-hmm. And it seems clear now that whole effort to centralize the government decision-making about what can be built where at Sacramento instead of here is moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, look, like it's worth repeating. I know we said this last week, but The set of facts on the table here about the local regulations and the state regulations and what you do when those two things are in conflict, nothing about those has changed any time recently. All of the precedents that the state cited in its decision were decades old. So what has changed is the state's willingness to put its thumb on the scale and get involved and settle these disputes. And if that's the case, like, this coastal height limit and the state density bonus are not the only local issue conflicting with a state issue that you could come up with if you were in the mood to brainstorm all of the different ways these things may play out in the future. I mean, the North City area, all of the suburban areas up in Carmel Valley and Del Mar Highlands and all that, they have their own set of development regulations and have for decades that were imposed by a voter initiative. They have elevated low-income housing requirements and fees associated with them. If this local initiative, the coastal height limit, does not trump the state's density bonus initiative, presumably the state's density bonus also can put its foot on the North City urbanizing areas elevated inclusionary housing requirements. Similarly, the state's density bonus program is not the only state law that has an effect on housing. As you mentioned, the Surplus Land Act is a state law. So I don't know, could a clever lawyer find a way to argue something related to the State Surplus Land Act and some other local regulation that's getting in the way of the, you know, the full spirit of the implementation of the Surplus Lands Act, whether that's at the sports arena or somewhere else?
Yeah.
I don't think it's like an especially, I don't think you have to be like all that clever to start spooling out the different ways that this ruling might have a pretty broad precedent.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in this part of San Diego and Ohio. Get the newsletter for this podcast at vosd.org/pod. That's again, vosd.org/pod. You'll get updates when we drop episodes, including bonus episodes and extra details and show notes about the stories we go over. Subscribe at vosd.org/pod. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice of San Diego. Andrea Lopez-Villafana is our Managing Editor. Andrew Keats is also Managing Editor. And Nate John is our producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.